I'm Bill Glazer. I'm co-founder and CEO of Outstanding Foods. We make pig out pigless pork rinds and take out puffs. And this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Startup Story. Before we jump into this week's episode, I want to share a few opportunities that you have to bring your business and brand to my audience of 85,000 listeners. And the first one is absolutely free. If you want to plug your brand in an upcoming episode of The Startup Story, then make sure to leave a written review on Apple Podcasts and make sure to plug your brand in that written review. That way, when I read your review in an episode, it will be like a free ad within an episode of The Startup Story. Again, this opportunity is completely free. It just takes a few moments of your time. The second opportunity is the traditional advertising route. This one you don't hear too much about because, well, like most startup founders, we're not the best at celebrating our successes. Well, brands that have advertised on The Startup Story have seen results that exceed all expectations. Brands like Brex and Design Pickle have come back and said the ROI from advertising with The Startup Story surpasses campaigns that they've run with shows 10 times the size of The Startup Story. So if you want to share your brand, product, or service with the Startup Story audience, then drop an email to advertise@thestartupstory.co and let's see if we can put together a great campaign concept for you. And one more thing before we jump into this week's episode. On April 21st, we begin a three-part live stream series with three incredible founders. And during this event, you will have the opportunity to ask your questions directly to some of the most successful founders of today. Founders like Matt Meeker, who co-founded Meetup and BarkBox, both had massively successful exits, are in two entirely different sectors. One event will feature Renee Blewett, the creator of She Did That, that has since been picked up by Netflix for distribution. She Did That is a platform that tells incredible stories of some powerful Black female founders. And our third featured founder is David Barnett, the inventor and founder of PopSockets. They have sold hundreds of millions of units, and he started as a philosophy professor. Again, this event begins April 21st. It's a three-part series, and you can register for access today. All three of these featured founders have a tremendous amount of value to share, and you will have the opportunity to bring your startup or business questions directly to them. So visit live.grindology.com to learn more. Again, live.grindology.com, and that's where you can register. Of course, we're going to include a link in the show notes for easy access. Now let's jump into this week's episode. My guest this week is Bill Glazer, co-founder of Outstanding Foods. Just last week, we had CPG expert Ryan Lewenden on the show, and one of the trends that he spoke about as being the next big boom in CPG was in plant-based foods. Well, Outstanding Foods is on the forefront of this industry shift. Bill is a serial entrepreneur with numerous successful exits, and in this episode, we get to hear about some critical decisions he made in bringing Outstanding Foods to market. Tactics that, if you're bringing a product to market in this category, you might want to listen very intently on. The Startup Story continues to deliver founder direct guidance, and this week's episode is no different. Yet, despite all of the massive successes that Bill has experienced, his journey had to start somewhere. And oftentimes, that origin story isn't too far off from our very own. Yet, it's the many subsequent decisions that make all the difference.
My father was someone that walked the line of wanting to be an entrepreneur, but also liking the security of getting a paycheck. Yeah. And he struggled with that. And as a kid, I saw both sides of that. My father was in advertising, and he had his own agency at least twice. I believe maybe even three times. He had three different agencies. Yeah. And he worked for other advertising agencies. And when he worked for other advertising agencies, he didn't have the stress of managing a business and all of the intricacies and you know, ups and downs that come with that. He was getting a weekly or biweekly paycheck, and he liked that. He struggled, though, with not being able to spread his wings and being his own boss, being able to, you know, take the swings that he wanted to swing. And so I saw both sides of the equation of what it was like to be an entrepreneur and what it was like to work for a company. And my father, who struggled with both because he was never all in on either. And so I think for me, I saw that I wanted to do my own thing. I didn't want to be contained. And that's, you know, really how I got my early entrepreneurial influence of wanting to take those swings.
You know, let me ask that question, though, because obviously there is an attraction to doing your own thing, to living without, you know, I was about to say living without boundaries. That's not really true. It's just a different set of boundaries and guidance in which we live by. But you also saw the less amount of stress in your dad's life in the paycheck era, if you will. You know, why were you still drawn to the entrepreneurial lifestyle?
Freedom.
Freedom.
And I saw that when he was stressed, it wasn't about the paycheck. It was about that his ideas weren't heard. It was about the politics of the company he was working for and whether they were going to recognize his work or whether he had the freedom to do what he wanted to do and bring in the type of accounts that he resonated with, that he was connected with, and not just, you know, be involved with companies or businesses that he was promoting as an advertiser that he didn't connect with. So the freedom not only to pursue what I wanted, but the freedom to do things that are meaningful to me. And those were lessons that I saw every day as a kid, the struggle that my father had with that.
I love that. Oh, and you're absolutely right. I mean, that resonates so deeply with me. But I have to ask this question because I love some of these early day hustle stories. You know, when did you start testing the water, even as a kid? When did you start testing the water on entrepreneurship?
Well, a lot earlier than my daughter will be able to do in the same vein. I have an 8-year-old daughter, and when I thought of what I was doing at an age much younger than hers, I'm like, there's no way that she would be doing that now. And that was when I was literally 4 years old, 4 and 5 years old. I was motivated by things and I wanted to get things. And there were these magazines, these boys' magazines that I used to read. And in one of them, in the back of it, was a magic kit that I wanted. And the way you got the magic kit was by selling greeting cards and vegetable seeds and earning points from those sales to get enough points to then get that magic kit. So I ordered all the supplies, the greeting cards, the vegetable seeds, with the help of my parents to send it in. And surprisingly, when I look back at 4 and 5 years old, I literally was by myself going door to door. And this is in the suburbs of New York, knocking on people's doors, opening the door. I didn't know a lot of those people. And at 4 or 5 years old, I had a pitch and I was selling vegetable seeds and greeting cards so that I can make those points, make that money to get that magic kit.
I love it. I love it. I love that you start off by saying, definitely nothing that I would allow my daughter to do. It is a different era. I mean, I remember, you know, mowing the lawn in third grade for neighbors. And it's like, you don't see kids that young these days out there doing that kind of work. And so it is definitely a different era.
Well, I encourage my daughter to pursue the thing she wants to pursue. And there's a lot of ways that she could be entrepreneurial if she chose to do that. But knocking on people's doors and going door to door at 4 years old, I sense that I probably would be reported as a, you know, some type of parent if that happened these days. And nor would I feel comfortable letting her do that. But if she wants to pursue something and spread her wings, I would fully encourage it. And I have encouraged it.
I love it.
Just not going door to door at 4 or 5 years old or even 8 years old.
Yeah. And plus kids today have online resources that we never had access to. I mean, my daughter is 15 and she populates her arts on Redbubble and Etsy and is making money that way. I mean, it's just amazing to me the resources kids have nowadays to pursue their entrepreneurial dreams if they have any, you know. So your daughter probably has a bunch of different ways she can monetize some of her passions, you know. But for you, as we come to the end of your high school years, as we continue to unpack your entrepreneurial journey, what did you think you wanted to do at the end of high school? Because high school is a natural end of one chapter and beginning of another. So what was that for you? What did you think the next steps were and what did you want to become?
Yeah, so when I was in high school, I was really good at math and I was also very creative and drew very well. And so for me, that combination was architecture. Mm. And I looked, when I was applying to colleges, I was looking at colleges that had an architectural program. And I also had an interest in finance. In high school, I was part of a investing club and had mock portfolios and also had my own stock that I, you know, used some money that I earned and bought stock and was exposed to that. So, you know, I was thinking whether I want to be an architect or I want to be in finance in some way. And the finance won over because I thought about, you know, while I'm creative and good at math, I don't want to sit at a desk and a station all day. I want to, you know, get out and live life and experience other things. And so that was the part of the architecture that drove me away from it. And then I went to college. I got a finance degree, economics minor. Throughout my childhood, I did things to make money, and they were often entrepreneurial things. I was mowing people's lawns, shoveling driveways during the wintertime. My father was in advertising, would often bring home samples of products he was advertising for, watch straps, rings, things like that. I would take them to school and I would sell them. And so I had that entrepreneurial drive. I had that ability to just figure out, like, okay, here's a product, let me go sell it, or here's my service, let me go sell it. But when I went to college, I studied finance and economics. And when I was graduating and interviewing for jobs, they were mostly focused on finance. And I fortunately got a very good job offer at a big investment banking firm, well-known, very respected. And it was one of these jobs that you start out at a certain point and rise through the ranks. Mm-hmm. And I accepted it. And I accepted it in part because that's what my parents wanted me to do. They felt, oh, this is a very prestigious investment banking firm. Yeah. This is a good job. And but there was a part of me that was uncomfortable with that decision, that was, okay, I'm getting into someone's corporate hierarchy. I'm going back to my father working for someone else, and this isn't me. And so I contemplated up until the day I was supposed to start. And that first day, I called them up and I said, I thank you very much for the opportunity, but I've decided I'm not going to take it. And of course, that didn't go over well with my parents. They were very disappointed. How could you give up such an opportunity? We pay for 4 years of college, you're ruining it. All of the things that a lot of kids hear when they want to pursue their own dream, that's different than what their parents' expectations are. And I heard that, and I heard that in a very heavy way. But I still pursued what resonated for me, despite those naysayers. And I understood where their perspective was, but it wasn't my perspective. And so I ended up still getting a job in finance, but one that was more sales oriented in financial sales. I was initially a financial advisor and then progressively moved into investment banking. But I was in a role where what I made was determined by my efforts. And that was very entrepreneurial to me and very skill building for me as well, in terms of how to sell. When you could sell one-on-one, you could sell one to many. And so I learned those skills doing that. And then, of course, 3 months later, after I had quit the job that I had taken that disappointed my parents, when I got the financial sales job, it was also at a respected company. And so after 3 months of hearing, what are you going to do with your life? Finally, it was, oh, I see now. And that makes sense. And it's a good decision. But I think it's really important, no matter what age you are, to make decisions for yourself that you know are going to be true for what resonates with you and that you're committed to doing and that you're passionate about, not just take a job based on other people's expectations.
Oh, I love it. And you know, I'm gonna make an assumption here that in that role you saw great success. And so now between that role and your first entrepreneurial venture, you know, what were the steps and how did you navigate that journey and why did you end up leaving it all to take the risk of starting your own thing? All right, before Bill explains why he took the leap into entrepreneurship, I need to ask you a question. How valuable would it be to have direct access to some of my past guests so that you can learn exactly how they executed certain strategies to grow their business? I have to believe that would be extremely helpful to your entrepreneurial journey. I mean, as someone who has access to these founders, I can tell you firsthand, it's incredibly helpful. And it is now available to you because that is the experience and knowledge sharing that is delivered to you each quarter when you become a Grindology member. Grindology is an entrepreneurial subscription box that ships every quarter full of resources to help fuel your grind and your hustle. Now you might be asking, what's included in a Grindology shipment? Well, first and foremost, every single Grindology shipment will include a copy of the Grindology Tactical Manual. Every single issue of Grindology will be chock full of real tactics from real business builders, not journalists. Within the pages of the Grindology Tactical Manual, we will be delivering to you tactics and strategies that you can integrate into your business immediately. How great would it be to receive Facebook ad strategies from those who are doing it? Wouldn't it be helpful if a successful founder laid out specific user acquisition strategies that they use to grow their business? Well, those are the types of tactics that will be found in each issue of Grindology. Like I said, real tactics from real business builders. In addition to the Grindology Tactical Manual, each shipment delivers 2 bags of uniquely crafted coffee specifically roasted for you, the founder, hustler, entrepreneur, maker, and creator. Each shipment also includes an exclusive mug that speaks to the unique nature that is you, the entrepreneur. I've said it numerous times, everything I do is about helping you in your entrepreneurial journey. So visit Grindology.com to learn more. We will include a link to Grindology.com within our show notes for easy access. Now let's jump back into our episode with Bill Glazer to find out why he would leave a corporate role that he was succeeding in to start his own venture.
Yeah, so I did start out in that role very successfully in the whole national class that I came into in this program. I was the number two person in sales, and the number one person inherited the book of clients from their father that worked at that same firm. And so I was making more money than my friends at that time. I thought that was a measure of success. I don't think that that's a measure of success in any way. In terms of, you know, how much money you make as the level of success. I think it's the level of success is what value you're creating, how you're helping other people. But at that time, I was more materialistic and was measuring myself that I'm essentially number one in this program and I've achieved something. But it wasn't enough for me. And I started seeing some trends in the market, and there was something that caught my eye that I saw an opportunity and started a business when I was, I believe, 23 years old. Was my first post-college entrepreneurial company.
And what was that business? What was the trend you saw and what was the business you started?
Yeah, that was during the first Persian Gulf War. And there was this tremendous surge of patriotism and a tremendous shortage of U.S. flags. And ironically, at that time and still now, you'd see a lot of U.S. flags that say made in China on the sticker on the flag. So I saw an opportunity that there was a demand and a shortage of supply. And so I figured out, okay, how do I make flags? And I sourced out all of the manufacturers. They all had backlogs in some cases for years, and decided then, okay, I'm going to make flags and I'm going to figure out what are the components of the flags? How do you produce these flags? And then how do you sell the flags? And while I was figuring out how to make them, I started selling them. And so I used a strategy that now is, you know, very akin to how email marketing is or text marketing. It was fax marketing, though, back then, where I was sending out mass faxes. But instead of pushing one button to send multiple faxes, I was pushing each button for each call and each fax number I was dialing. And they were buyers of chain stores, all types of pharmacies, discount department stores, and a variety of others. And so sending one fax at a time, all day, all night, with an offer, with a headline, we have U.S. flags, and in 3 weeks generated $1 million worth of purchase orders. And so the hustle of figuring out how to make them intensified. I sourced out all of the raw materials. I contracted a company to print them and to assemble them. And I even figured out how to finance some of that with receivables because I was dealing with some bigger companies. I borrowed money from my father that was uncomfortable for me to ask and uncomfortable for him to provide. He wasn't the richest guy in the world, and so it was a stretch for him, but he supported me. And when I went to fulfill that first order, I got a sample of what was going to be sent to this big chain store. And I open up the box, extremely excited that, okay, I have $1 million of sales in 3 weeks, and this is going to turn into tens of millions. And I'm counting, I'm seeing the vision ahead of me. And I open up the box, take out the first flags, and everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. They were printed with the wrong color ink. They were cut unevenly. They had glue on the sticks. And all of that dream, that vision came tumbling down. What do I do? How do I pay back my father? How do I remedy this? Is there a way to remedy this? And ultimately, I wasn't able to fulfill those orders. The $1 million of purchase orders evaporated. owed my father what was for me a bunch of money at the time and for him as well, and created a bunch of dynamics. But in retrospect and soon after that, there were a lot of lessons that I came out of that first journey with that I took into other businesses that I started.
That's amazing. And as soon as you said Persian Gulf, man, my mind just went back to one of my entrepreneurial hustles when I was in middle school during that time. I mean, for those who don't know, the Persian Gulf War, one of the most efficient wars we've ever had. That patriotism was at an all-time high. And all I did was create images on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper that people can put in their binder sleeves to show in the front. And I was selling for $1 a pop. And I was making hundreds of dollars in middle school just selling these 8.5 by 11. I mean, so I love, as soon as you mentioned it, and you talk about flags, I immediately went back to that place. Like, oh my goodness, I remember that. And but as you were telling that story, there's so many lessons that I think people would never have the opportunity today to learn because of just, it's a different day and era. Like you mentioned the faxing, right? The fax marketing. And for most people, there's probably a significant population of my audience that doesn't even know what faxing is, right? Like I remember when we transitioned from faxing to e-fax online, and that was a big deal. And they probably don't even use e-fax anymore. But when you think through the many lessons that you've learned from just that period, how crucial in your entrepreneurial journey is that season, those, let's say, 30 to 90 days, whatever, however long that venture was, how critical is that season to where you are today?
Very, because one, I learned about financing a business. I learned the right way, I learned the wrong way. I also learned that it wasn't just that a business didn't succeed and that I owed money back. It was that I didn't set the proper expectations. I showed my father these purchase orders, $1 million. This is a can't lose proposition. And didn't understand the risk to even be able to explain the risk. And had I properly explained the risk, it wouldn't have created as much friction that became into the relationship with my father and myself. And so I learned not only how to raise money, but how to be transparent with not only the opportunity, but the risks. I learned that selling is only one aspect of a business. You could be very good at selling a product, very good at marketing a product, but if you don't have the substance of the product and the product to deliver, then none of that other stuff matters. You need all of those elements. And so I was really good at the selling. My first role outside of college, as I mentioned, I gained a lot of very good sales training, selling one-on-one. It makes it much easier to understand the psychology of individuals to understand how to position and sell to the masses. But I wasn't very good at creating a product at that stage in my career. Mm-hmm. And so I learned very deeply that the product matters and the quality of the product matters and the delivery and the value that someone gets matters a lot.
Oh, absolutely love that. It's so rich. And I hope all of my listeners caught on to that, because there's so much wisdom in what Bill just shared in the last 4 minutes. So if you didn't get a chance to catch it all because you were driving or you're running, go back, rewind it, get a notepad and pen out, and just make notes of all the things he just unpacked within that lesson. And again, and that was a fast period, right? I mean, again, Persian Gulf War was a 30-day war, I think maybe 40 days. And so that season, that flag company that you had started, I assume, again, was a 30 to 90 day venture, a 30 to 90 day experiment, if you will. What happened after that for you?
Yeah, so I went back into finance, and okay. I then became an more of an entrepreneur in finance on the investment banking side, where progressively I started taking companies public, raising capital, advising on the growth of those businesses, advising on mergers and acquisitions. And I had many deals that I did over the years, some with companies that I work with and others on my own journey. I had my own financial advisory company that did very well for many years. And then, being involved with other people's companies where I'm helping with the resources and the strategy, but not pulling the levers of making decisions, it got me much more motivated to going back in and being the entrepreneur and I was an entrepreneur in my finance business, but being an entrepreneur of creating a product and marketing and selling the product.
And was that next product, I know it's not Outstanding Foods, we're not there yet, what was that next product?
Well, I've had a number of different companies along the years. I had a multimedia company that produced and marketed fitness DVDs and yoga DVDs. I had a nutraceutical company that we sourced all the raw ingredients, sold them as blends to supplement companies, and had proprietary supplements as well. I had the financial advisory company, a tech company that had mobile platforms and web platforms. And so a number of different things along the way. And I think, you know, what isn't, people should always follow what they're passionate about and what they're interested in, but it doesn't mean you have to live in a box, because when you become an entrepreneur and you gain certain skills of marketing, of selling, of financing, of hiring and managing, those are applicable to any industry. So each industry, each product has its own nuances and its own market that you have to approach a little bit differently. But the core of being an entrepreneur are those things that I just mentioned. And so if you're good at that, you could be good in any industry. And so I found things that I was interested in, but it was really until Outstanding Foods that is my true passion, something that I've personally lived and something that I really make an impact, which is really what drives me.
I love it. So we're on the cusp of Outstanding Foods, and I'm gonna say we're on the front doormat, ready to open the door and jump into what Outstanding Foods is. But let's talk about that season right before Outstanding Foods, right before the idea of Outstanding Foods comes into your brain, into your environment. What were you doing, and where were you at in life at that point?
So the idea didn't just come in at the time that I started the company. And I think this is also important for people to understand that I had a seed that was planted, that it wasn't the right time when the seed was planted, but then the timing aligned, the people aligned at a later point. And so I think, you know, a lot of times people try to force things, and they have an idea and they at all costs try to jump into that idea. Mm. And sometimes the idea is not ready. The market is not ready. The people that you could attract is not as high level as it can be. And so I've personally been plant-based for 31 years. I thought about doing a plant-based business years ago, and I planted that seed. I had the dialogue with my current co-founder back then, and it wasn't the right time. It wasn't, the market wasn't ready. The partnership wasn't ready. He was involved in other things that were hard for him to extract himself from. And so we had that seed planted. And then it was at the time that he reached out to me, my current co-founder, Chef Dave Anderson, that I said, okay, let's do it. And I dropped everything I was doing and you know, progressively unwound myself from the things that were my core. But prior to that, I had a tech company. We were developing mobile apps. We had acquired a number of mobile and web properties, growing business, good opportunity, something I was interested in. But when I got the call that rung the bell of, this is your passion, this is something you live, this is something you understand, and this is something you can make a big impact, it was an absolute no-brainer. It was hell yes, let's do it. Let's figure out the details from there.
I love it. Now, let's put a timestamp on that. When did that hell yes happen?
The hell yes happened about 5 years ago. And so there was a period of time for me to transition out of what I was doing at the time, full time, which was the tech company, and for my co-founder to transition out of what he was doing. He was at Beyond Meat. He led R&D and product development at Beyond Meat for about 4.5 years, led the team that created the Beyond Burger, and he single-handedly created all their early products as well.
Wow.
And so there was a process for both of us to transition to then form Outstanding Foods, but then also to figure out, okay, we're partnering, you're a genius at creating plant-based food products that taste just like meat, that don't require a sacrifice for consumers. I'm an experienced entrepreneur. We're doing this together, but what are we doing? We didn't know yet. And so we have to figure that out too.
Oh, I love it. So now we are about to jump into what Outstanding Foods is. And so for my audience that doesn't know what Outstanding Foods is, and maybe not have heard of any of the products that you offer, can you explain to everyone what Outstanding Foods is?
Yes, we make plant-based foods that are primarily snacks that are replacing meat and dairy products. So our first product was a plant-based pork rind under our brand Pig Out. It's a Pig Out pigless pork rind. It's got the highest amount of protein on the market as a plant-based snack at 7 grams an ounce. Tastes ridiculous. People are addicted to it. They love the taste and they love the fact that it's plant-based and high in protein. We then launched a cheese puff that's completely dairy-free. that is loaded with vitamins and nutrients. It's got 20 vitamins and minerals in it. It's got a good source of things like iron and calcium and vitamin B12 and D, things that you would never expect to have in a snack. So you're not only getting guilt-free snacking, you're actually getting a lot of nutrition and also a lot of protein. We came out recently with a plant-based bacon seasoning product under our Pig Out brand. And we have some other really high-level innovative products that we lead with taste. Everything has to taste really great and have a similar texture to what people are used to. But we're innovating with nutrition, really not only just taking out the bad stuff, but adding in really high level, high quality ingredients, but high levels of nutrients that you would not normally expect to find in things like snacks or cheeses or other products that we plan to do.
Now, when you had this idea for Outstanding Foods, what was the actual problem you were wanting to solve? Like you were in this mobile tech space. An idea came to begin. You were living a meat-free lifestyle. You were a plant-based diet, you know, and so I know it's part of who you were, but what was the problem you were trying to solve that led you to this concept of Outstanding Foods?
So I think the biggest problem was that there was an interest in people wanting to eat more plant-based foods for a variety of reasons. But I'm big into psychology and consumer behavior. And if someone has to make a sacrifice to be able to incorporate a new food into their diet, it's very hard to do. We all know January 1st, we get inundated with all the gym commercials and, and advertisements because people are motivated January 1st. I'm going to make change. I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to lose that 10 pounds. I'm going to lose that 20 pounds. But it's hard to stick to something new. It's hard to create new habits and new behaviors for most of us. And so we didn't want to have new habits and behaviors created for people to enjoy our products. We wanted to make it very easy for anyone to incorporate more plant-based foods into their diet because they taste great and there's no sacrifice, no loss of taste, no loss of texture. They're sold where people shop. They're at a price point that is similar to what you would buy meat and dairy products for. And those were the essential ingredients, so to speak, of what we brought into our products. But that was the problem solution, making it seamless to incorporate our products into their diet and then into their lifestyle without having any sacrifice.
I love, you know, just last week we had an episode with Ryan Lewenden, who is an IP attorney that specializes in the CPG space. And he unpacked for us some of the trends that he sees as the opportunities within CPG. And one of them was plant-based products, you know, not just from the consumable perspective, but also from hygiene as well. I just thought in the plant-based space, it's just a tremendous market. People are wanting healthy alternatives on the consumption side. And so when I first heard that Outstanding Foods had a pork rind with X amount of grams of protein, I thought that's super interesting because I remember, to your point about consumers not wanting to sacrifice, there was a season where my wife and I lived a vegetarian lifestyle, but it only lasted for 2 years. And I'll tell you what my sticking point was as to why I jumped ship and went back to meat was I found lots of great substitutes for all kinds of different meats. I could not find a substitute for bacon. And I know it sounds petty, it sounds small, but to your point about consumer behavior, you know, we all have a threshold in which we are willing to sacrifice and what we're not willing to sacrifice. And when you have innovators like yourself that are looking for ways to solve those thresholds and bring people into this healthy lifestyle for even a little bit longer is if you can solve for those things. And so for us, it was trying to solve for bacon. We just could not find a solve around that. And so we could not get into a full vegetarian lifestyle because, well, bacon is heavenly. So I'm anxious to try these pork rinds that you've produced. So
yeah, and I think that's important in any business is that if you have to have someone change a behavior or adopt a new behavior, you have an uphill battle to climb because if people aren't used to doing something, it's hard to stick to it. With food in particular, if Beyond Meat was trying to sell a bean burger to people that bought Whoppers and Big Macs, they might get some people that were open to trying it and let's see what this is. You know, I would much rather eat the plant-based version than from an animal, or I'm into the environment or whatever it might be. So let me give this a shot. Are they going to stick with it? Most of them no, because it's a completely different taste, a completely different texture. Even if the motivation is there to try it, the stick-to-itiveness for most people won't, because it's a new behavior. Mm. And so I think that in any product that any company launches, if it requires a new behavior, then you're already halfway lost the battle, or at least, if not even more.
You know, one of the things that when it comes to solving problems and innovating, it's identifying who our ideal persona is, right? Who is our buying persona? When you consider Outstanding Foods, is your buyer the plant-based diet person? Is your buyer someone who is health conscious but is still a meat eater? Like, how do you identify your buyer?
So for us, the market is the mainstream. And so in that mainstream, there are people that consider themselves flexitarian, trying to eat less meat, trying to eat more healthy products. There are certainly vegans and vegetarians or pescatarians. And so we're going after everyone because our products taste great. And we have a brand that we think is accessible and relatable to people. We're a brand that we don't judge people. We don't make people wrong for their choices. We don't preach. We're not trying to, you know, stand up on a soapbox and tell you why you shouldn't do that and you should do this. We're trying to make it easy for anyone to incorporate more plant-based foods into their diet, because they're not losing anything from what they have, they taste great, and they're highly nutritious.
Why is a plant-based lifestyle important for you from a consumer adoption perspective? Not just important for you personally, but why is it important for you to lower the barrier to entry to a plant-based lifestyle for consumers?
Well, we're not trying to convert people to a plant-based lifestyle. If some of them are inclined to do that, then that's certainly their prerogative. And if they're not, that's certainly their prerogative. So we're not telling people what they should do or how they should do it. Again, we're just making it easy for them to incorporate more plant-based foods into their diet because our products taste great and they don't require a sacrifice. So we don't preach to people of this is what you should do and why you should do it. We know people are already interested in trying to eat more plant-based foods. Many reasons are now motivating people. Environment is a big one for a lot of people. But if you could preach all you want about something, but if the product doesn't deliver, like I said, the first lesson I got from my first post-college company, if the product doesn't deliver, it doesn't matter all of the rationale of why you should eat a product like that. What matters is how good the product is. And with a food product, the first thing that is the good part is the taste and the texture. And so that's what we lead with. We also lead with high quality, nutritious ingredients. I think there's this trend right now of a lot of science in plant-based food products, a lot of ingredients that are hard to pronounce. I think as people start eating some of these things and start associating being more identifying as someone that eats more plant-based foods, then the next wave, in my opinion, of plant-based products are the ones that are using cleaner ingredients, are using more nutritious ingredients. So we'd like to think we're innovating on that space as well.
I love it. Now, when you and your co-founder got together, and obviously your co-founder has extensive experience in creating nutrition, or really, I mean, innovating in the plant-based space. I mean, again, Beyond Burger, all the other things that he's been a part of. So when I picture roles and responsibilities, I can picture the manufacturing and the recipe building and the development of product on his side. On your side, I'm going to assume a lot of the operations and capital and the fundraising and the branding side of things. Is that a fair assessment of the two roles when you first started?
Yes, but there is an overlap to those because a product development also has to be mindful of the category and how it's going to be positioned and the flavors and, of course, the costs and everything else. So at the early stages, when it was just myself and my co-founder, we now have over 20 people. We're still early, but growing fast. We were both very integral in both sides of the equation because they connect, and you can't, you know, have complete separation because if one person's developing a product and the other is focused on the marketing and sales, the positioning, the market psychology, the differentiation of the product, its unique selling proposition, there could be a disconnect. So you have to really holistically, and this is in any early stage entrepreneurial company, holistically, you know, a lot of people wear a lot of hats, but I think it's not just from a resource standpoint or resource needs, But I think it's important that people wear a lot of hats, because then you could understand the business better and not just compartmentalize the skills or the roles to understand how they all fit together and how they all need to be communicating with each other to figure these things out.
I love it. You know, well, you brought up a great point when you talk about the unique selling proposition and some of the early decisions. And I, again, not coming from a food background, not coming from a CPG space, but I would assume one of the harder earlier decisions is to figure out what is our coming out product? Like, what is the first outstanding food that we're going to produce? How did you get to what your first product was?
So you would have loved the first product idea, which was bacon strips, plant-based bacon strips. And so when we looked at the market, when my co-founder, Chef Dave Anderson, and I were sitting down, we looked at, okay, there are a couple of companies doing burgers really well. There's some cheese companies, plant-based, that are doing it really well. Where do we have the biggest opportunity? Because Dave has a breadth of experience in developing products in multiple categories. So we weren't limited by, okay, he's just good at this or just good at that. It was, where do we find the biggest opportunity? Initially for us, that was bacon. We felt that the bacon market was substantial. It was over $6 billion in the US, that there were no plant-based companies doing it well. All the plant-based bacon strips on the market and still today are preach to the choir products. They're vegan bacon strips for vegan consumers.
Yeah.
For someone that eats bacon, if you try any of the products that are on the market right now, you'll likely be repulsed, but it has no similarity to bacon other than it's a strip and it's got some smokiness and you know, some elements, but it doesn't have the consistency or the texture or the flavor that real bacon has. So we saw that as the opportunity. When Dave started developing the strip, what I started thinking about was the marketing strategy and the positioning. And while the paradigm is shifting, where more plant-based meats are now being sold in the meat aisle, most are still sold in the plant-based meat aisle. And if you don't shop at the plant-based meat aisle, you're not going to shop at the plant-based meat aisle. And so again, with habits, we didn't want to have to change people's habits. We adapted then our first product to fit the category that people were already in mass going to, and most people are shopping the snack aisle. So we pivoted that initial idea to go into the snack aisle. We're going to come back to bacon at some point, but we launched our brand with something that we felt we could reach the most amount of consumers and without having to change any habits.
That is brilliant. I mean, just to hear the mental processes behind that is so incredibly rich. And again, part of why I love the startup story and love hearing from founders like yourself is just hear some of the new thinking that goes into what SKU do we come out with? How do we approach product development? How do we approach our unique selling proposition? Like all the things in which every founder thinks differently. And that's the value of this collective of sharing this information. So thank you so much for sharing that. To continue on with the early day decisions, the early day conversations that take place, you know, you had some success, before Outstanding Foods, as did your co-founder. But I don't want to assume that this is a self-funded venture. Are you venture backed? Are you a Series A? Where are you at in your fundraising process right now?
We raised the $10 million Series A that we closed on late 2020. And so prior to that, though, we were more strategic and we financed our business a little bit atypical than most businesses finance. We do have some venture capital investors, but we limited them in terms of how much they invested. Most of our early investors before the Series A are strategic investors, and most of those strategics are celebrities and influencers because we're in the age of influencer marketing. People follow what their favorite celebrities or influencers are promoting. And it's very hit or miss if you pay influencers or celebrities to get an ROI. So my strategy was, instead of going down that path and potentially not getting the right ROI and paying a lot of money, especially if you bring in celebrities, was attracting them as investors. And so also, we were in an environment where a lot of celebrities were already conditioned to doing that. We didn't have to convince them of why it made sense. People like Ashton Kutcher and 50 Cent and Jennifer Aniston who who have invested in companies and made substantial amount because they use their personality and their audience to promote the companies and the products that they had invested in. There was already a pathway for us to then go to other celebrities and influencers without having to convince them of why that they should be investing and why they shouldn't have their manager or their agent part of these conversations. And so we did that. And we were, you know, fortunately successful in attracting a wide range of celebrities and influencers. We have people like Snoop Dogg and Rob Dyrdek and Emily Deschanel and influencers that you might not have heard of, but that have millions of YouTube subscribers and TikTok and Instagram followers. And so we've used them not only to promote our products organically, but many of them have created content for us. And many of those we've used in paid ads that have performed really well for us.
I love it. And what I love about that too is, had we had this conversation, you know, 5-8 years ago, that probably wouldn't have been something one heard of. I mean, 50 Cent was really the first one with vitamin water, right? 50 Cent and Baron Davis, the two of them collectively together with vitamin water. But it wasn't spoken of a lot, right? Even Dr. Dre and Beats, I mean, the way that collaboration came to be was very similar model, but it just wasn't spoken of a lot. Now, you know, within the 2020 episodes alone, you're the second guest I've had that has launched their product in a similar model. The other one being Magic Spoon, the high protein cereal company. Gabby Lewis and team, they did a similar model as well. So it's fascinating to me to see the shift in the go-to-market strategy, leveraging capital or leveraging equity within the influencer market. And so when did your product hit the shelves for the first time? When do you consider your launch date?
Yeah, February 2020 was when we launched our Pig Out Pigless Pork Rinds direct to consumer. And in March 2020, we started taking it to retail. And so DTC for us was always the centerpiece of our marketing strategy. I had a company about 10 years ago. We used 30-minute infomercials to sell our fitness DVD series. And so at that time, any product that was sold through infomercial or other media always got best shelf space in retailers. You'd always see As Seen on TV. Mm. They'd get the best at checkout in the center aisles because the retailers knew that consumers are walking into the store likely having seen those infomercials or heard those radio commercials and are more likely not only to know that product, but more likely to buy it. So that was the strategy we used in using direct-to-consumer first. We benefited greatly from the early parts of COVID when a lot of advertisers stopped advertising, so customer acquisition costs were low.
Yeah.
Consumer behavior was trending towards buying food products and having them delivered safely at people's homes. So we were in the right place at the right time in direct to consumer to really grow our brand fast. We went in just a few months, we were doing over 400,000 a month in our direct to consumer channel. So we grew that channel fast and continued to grow it. It's now become very crowded. A lot of food brands, a lot of brands in all categories have pivoted into DTC, as well as a lot of multinational companies. And so the costs are higher. But that was where we launched initially in February 2020. We started taking our product to retail in March, initially with independents, regional chains. Now we're in Walmarts, Kroger's, 7-Elevens, and others. And growing our distribution domestically and internationally.
You know, when you think of, again, the fact that you launched February of 2020, just last year, I mean, we're talking 13 months ago, right? When you think of the many challenges and obstacles that you've had to deal with over the last, let's say, 2 to 3 years, what do you look at as some of the, maybe the singular greatest obstacle you've had to deal with in bringing outstanding foods to market?
Well, I think there's always, no matter what you do, there's always going to be obstacles, challenges, and opportunities. And so it's how you navigate those. And so, you know, we launched a food product without having a single trade show. And food products in particular, but all products, typically you have trade shows where the buyers are attending, they're sampling the products, they're seeing the products, they have an opportunity to have one-on-one conversation. And we launched a product to retail market with zero trade shows, which is, you know, an unusual time for the last year or so has been unusual in multiple ways, but for a new food brand, unheard of. And so we can complain about that. We can complain about retailers initially at the first part of COVID were focused on restocking their shelves and didn't want to hear about new products. We can choose to complain about that, or we could adapt and say, okay, this is what the environment is now. How do we penetrate this market? What are we going to do? We're not going to wait for a new platform to come along. We're not going to wait for the environment to change. What can we do to make sure that our product is getting where we want it to go and get it on the shelves? And so, you know, there were certainly some COVID casualties of retailers that weren't bringing new products into the shelves, but we made things happen no matter what. And I think that's what, you know, any company during any product launch has to figure out, is not the tried and true way that things have been done before, but when challenges happen, how do you navigate that challenge? How do you figure out solutions and be creative to adapting?
You know, I love that. And, you know, it makes me think of this one quote from Jason McCann from formerly Veridesk. You know, one of the things that he had mentioned numerous times about entrepreneurship is that there's this idea that entrepreneurs are risk takers. And the reality is that we're not necessarily risk takers, we're risk managers, right? We understand that there's a risk to be had with bringing our own venture, you know, our own venture to market. And you could have delayed until post-COVID era to bring outstanding foods to market, but you didn't, right? And then again, back to risk management. Every decision is a management of some level of risk, right? We're trying to mitigate as much as possible. But when you think of your entrepreneurial journey, and again, in this episode, you've listed quite a few different industries and products in which you have brought a venture to market. And so when you think of risk, how do you think of risk and how do you manage or mitigate it?
Well, as a New Yorker that talks with my hands, I live in Los Angeles now. You've probably seen I've been talking with my hands a lot, and I have this little thing on, which I broke my wrist recently and had surgery, had to get a plate and screws put in, and it was from being a risk taker. And so I was at a ski mountain with my 8-year-old daughter. We were sledding. It was very icy. She wasn't really having it. It was too bumpy and too icy. We were looking for a better spot on the mountain where she might enjoy it more. And I saw this jump that someone had built for snowboarding, and they had built it when there was snow, not ice. And when my daughter was out, didn't want to sled anymore, I'm like, I have to hit that jump. And so I went to the top of the mountain. We had friends there. That one of my friends is like, you're going to hit that? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, dude, go for it. And normally before I do something, I'll assess the risk and I will mitigate the risk and I will set intention and I will visualize what I'm going to do and how I'm going to do it. In this case, I went to the top of the mountain. It was icy. I didn't purvey and look at where I was going to land. My friend said, go for it. And I went for it. And I had a great time going down the hill. I had a great time hitting that jump and flying in the air. Landing, I have to work on a little bit. And so, you know, I came away from that with, you know, some valuable lessons. One, I shouldn't be wearing sunglasses, metal frame sunglasses. I don't know if you could see, but I got stitches on my face after I fell as well. I broke my wrist. And so, you know, I came out of that with reflection of, yes, I didn't do some of the things I normally do of assessing the risk, of planning for what I was going to do. And I that was a real lesson and I paid the price. And I think it's, as an entrepreneur, it's good to take some big swings and to take some risks. But if you take that metaphor into baseball where it started, there's a lot of home run hitters that all they do when they step up to the plate is they take that big swing. And there are some of these guys that, you know, have 40, 50 home runs in a year, but batting average is, you know, hovering around 200. And so that's not sustainable by just taking the big swing. It feels good when you connect and when the ball goes over the fence. But if that's all you're doing, that's not going to be a sustainable thing as an entrepreneur. You can't just take wild swings. You can't just take wild swings regularly. You have to mitigate your risk and you have to assess how you're going to operate, and you have to be adaptive and not have tunnel vision, because sometimes even with the most thought out, well-developed plans, the environment isn't what you planned, and things come into your environment that you couldn't anticipate that you have to adapt to. And if you're traveling with tunnel vision, you're also not adapting to the ever-changing risks. So I think it's important to take risk, but to be adaptable and to be self-reflecting so that you can actually navigate as you're going and not just have blindly following your initial plan, because almost in all cases, things change.
Oh, I love that. That was so rich. Thank you so much for sharing that. You know, and it leads me to ask this question, though, for you, from your perspective, from your vantage point, from your years of experience, do you think anybody can be an entrepreneur, or is there a certain makeup in order to be an entrepreneur?
Well, I think like anything, skills can be developed. There's an inherent mindset that I think is certainly helpful. If you're someone that, you know, has been a risk taker, someone that is not afraid to put yourself out there, someone that is creative and adaptive, I think those are all qualities and all skills. But like anything, there are skills that you could develop. I developed some of those skills by observing my father, as I mentioned. And so those weren't necessarily inherent. Those were things that I observed and things that I decided and made decisions on. And then I got better at selling. I got better at building products by having failures and learning from those failures. And so they were actually successes to me because I learned from them and I adapted. If I didn't learn and I was just pigheaded about, okay, I'm just gonna sell something and figure out the product, you know, as an afterthought, then they would have been failures. And so I think those are things that are learned and that are skills and that take sharpening and development over experiences and, you know, really being open to seeing things as they unfold and as you reflect on them. Those are really where you can gain wisdom, and not just, you know, from your own reflection, hearing other people's input and hearing other people's thoughts and then processing that information to make decisions. So yes, I think anyone can be an entrepreneur, but you have to be determined to build your craft and build your skill and learn and adapt and become more of, someone that thinks outside of the box, but is able to adapt. And I think I have this analogy that, you know, a lot of people read a lot of books and they get motivated. And a lot of us have read the book called Think and Grow Rich, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this story in Think and Grow Rich of 4 feet from gold. Are you familiar with that story?
Yes.
Where someone digs for gold and then gives up. And someone else comes along, they say, oh, this is a big hole that's already been dug and there's probably gold down there. I'm gonna go in and I'm gonna dig. And 4 feet after the other guy gave up, they strike this gold mine. And so the persistence is something that you need as an entrepreneur, because things often don't come easily. You have to persist. But as I mentioned, you need the ability to not only adapt, but to discern. Because sometimes you should abandon the plan that you had and go elsewhere. Because if you keep digging 4 feet from where you stopped, you're not always going to hit gold. Sometimes you might hit a sewage line and all that sewage is going to spray all over you. So you have to have the ability to persevere, but to discern when the time is to change and adapt your plan and then persevere through that new plan.
Oh man, that was incredible. Thank you so much for sharing that. You know, one of the things you also mentioned in that was the idea of just kind of listening to those around you, listening to some outside influences. And it reminds me of the false narrative out there about entrepreneurship, where it's kind of this, you know, you and a laptop in this isolated vacuum of just building your venture. And entrepreneurship can be an isolating event. I mean, a lot of people do kind of just tuck themselves away as they're working on their craft and their business. But it's not the norm. It's not the best path to success, if you will. I believe that's in community. And so when you look across your entire entrepreneurial journey, who are the people that you look to with such immense gratitude for their contribution to where you are today?
Yeah, when I was younger, I was a go-it-alone type of guy. And I was more shy. I was less outgoing. It might seem, you know, a little surprising seeing me now, but I was a go-it-alone guy. And I often, you know, made decisions in isolation. And sometimes those served me well. And other times I did myself a disservice by not taking feedback. And so, you know, I've been fortunate that as I've grown, not only in age, but, you know, in shedding some of the walls that I had built up as a kid and becoming more, you know, of who I truly was, to then be more humble, to get people's insight, to get people's opinion. And so I fortunately have a lot of really good friends, some, you know, many of that are entrepreneurs that go through their own journey. I've been in entrepreneur organizations that, you know, are kind of a support group for entrepreneurs where you can share your experiences and your journey and learn from other entrepreneurs. And I think, you know, there are also iconic entrepreneurs that, you know, have had their path that are always worth studying and looking and modeling certain things. There's you know, always things from successful entrepreneurs that anyone can adapt, and also things that you have to be able to discern that aren't the right things for you. So I think taking feedback is very important, but also the discernment of not blowing in the wind and listening to every opinion and every thought that other people have, but processing those to find where you can get those valuable nuggets that can serve you well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, before we get to our last question, because I want to honor our time together as well as honor our listeners' time. But before we get to the last question, you know, if we were having a Where Are They Now episode, and let's say 5 years from now, where would Outstanding Foods be?
Well, Outstanding Foods, everyone's going to know about us. Our products are going to be in their homes. They're going to be surprised at how great foods taste when they're not made from the ingredients that they grew up eating. And those are ingredients that are both meat, dairy, and then all of the crap. You know, there's a lot of crap in a lot of traditional foods. And so they're going to be surprised that something healthy for you, something made from plants, tastes so good and that they really enjoy. Because the paradigm in the past were the healthy things were the kale chips, and you know that were they might taste you know, they might be healthy for you, but they don't taste great and they don't have an experience that you enjoy. So I think, you know, for us, 5 years from now, we're going to be in just about everyone's homes, and we're going to be in multiple categories. We have a big vision. We start that vision though being very, very hyper focused. So we're in a category, snacks. We're developing innovative snacks. We're dealing with the same buyers from one product to the next, so we don't have to build new distribution for each product. Mm. But over time, the vision is bigger that we're going to go into other categories. I mentioned cheese before. I mentioned bacon. So look for us to be in different categories. I think we will likely be a public company. We're seeing an opportunity in the market. There's more of a demand for companies since Beyond Meat and other companies have gone public in our space. And I think, you know, as a company that has the kind of product development resources we have, later on, we can even aggregate some companies and bring them under our umbrella and help those companies, those products improve and gain distribution.
I love that. Absolutely love it. I look forward to that. I look forward to that future episode to unpack and kind of do a compare and contrast and see how the trajectory went. But as our time does come to an end, you know, I would love the opportunity for all of my listeners to have some one-on-one time with you to unpack your brain, for them to get their questions answered direct if possible, but it's just unreasonable. With 85,000 listeners, I just can't afford that. So what I try to do is I try to simulate something like that, and that's the one-on-one coffee chat, if you will. So if you were having coffee with one of my listeners, and they were just trying to talk about the challenges that they've had in, let's say, the last year, the last, you know, 12 months navigating COVID, and some businesses are hanging on by a thread, and they're also trying to navigate the D2C market, right? They're within the CPG space, but they just continue to hit hurdles. What would be some words of encouragement you would leave them with as you're having your time together?
Well, I think the biggest thing is the attitude of how you approach those challenges, because a lot of people, when things don't go the way they expect or the way they want, they get disappointed and they get overwhelmed in a lot of cases. And so if you're like, oh, this sucks because of COVID, or this sucks because of that, you're already defeating the potential of you finding a solution. So I think instead of that attitude, I think it's the most important thing is first shifting the dynamic of, okay, this is now what's happening. Where is the opportunity for us? What can we do to adapt to this? And that actually creates an environment for creativity and for new ideas to come about, new ways to tackle, to find solutions to obstacles or problems. So I think the first thing is change your attitude and look at these not as bad things that have happened to you, and don't feel like a victim, but look at these as this is an unbelievable opportunity for us to stand out, because everyone is going through the same thing. Everyone has the same obstacles. We now have an opportunity to stand out and to differentiate ourselves in a big way through how we figure out and solve this problem.
Once you've had a few moments to process all the value Bill Glazer brought us in this week's episode, please hit me up on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram and share with me your thoughts on this episode. In fact, I hope you'll show up for Bill and visit OutstandingFoods.com and give their products a try. You can try their Pig Out Pigless Pork Rinds or the Meal in a Bag Takeout Puffs. In fact, don't just try one bag, buy a variety pack and share it with your friends. You know, if you've been around the Startup Story for any length of time, then you know how much emphasis I put on the idea that entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. So let's show up for Bill Glazer in a huge way by visiting OutstandingFoods.com as a show of appreciation for all the value he delivered to us today. In fact, if you're an overachiever, then share the URL OutstandingFoods.com on your social platforms. You know just as well as I do, awareness is everything to a startup. And now for my personal ask. The Startup Story community has been so incredible about sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We too are a startup, and word of mouth is everything. So please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Startup Story, or on Twitter at Startup Story _. If you're on LinkedIn, please search for The Startup Story and follow our company page. LinkedIn is a really powerful way to raise awareness of the show. But the most impactful way you can help us grow our audience is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you listen to the show via Spotify, then please simply share the podcast directly from your Spotify app or wherever you listen to the show. These simple actions can make a huge impact in getting these amazing founder stories out to the masses. And please make sure to tag or mention The Startup Story when you do share so that we can connect with you and say thank you directly. I'm so incredibly appreciative of the fact that you listen to this show each and every week. And I look forward to sharing these amazing stories with you every Tuesday with hopes of encouraging and inspiring you to start your story.